listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
Novelist, poet, and activist. Belli's most recent work, Infinity in the Palm of Your Hand, was awarded the 2008 Biblioteca Breve Prize. She is a resident of Los Angeles and Managua, Nicaragua. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Gioconda Belli and Isabel Allende to the Harutani Japan America Theater.
Gracias. Wow. Thank you. You make me feel like a celebrity. Thank you so much. Who speaks Spanish here? Oh, my God. Well, I have been touring for this book, The Island Beneath the Sea. I have been doing 13 cities in 19 days. It's a massacre. And I will sign all the books that you have brought, but I cannot personalize. I'm sorry, but we have to move the line, and I want to sign for everybody. So thank you for coming. Thank you very, very much. And thank you for reading my stuff. This new book, The Island Beneath the Sea, I started researching 4 years ago, long before the earthquake in Haiti. But already Katrina had happened in New Orleans. And I had been in New Orleans before Katrina, fell in love with the city because it's a wonderful city, unique in the United States with a very particular flavor. Is there anybody from New Orleans in the audience? No? Oh, yeah. Oh, okay, great. Well, you know what I'm talking about. It's a very, very special place. And I thought, I went there to research for a novel that I wrote called Zorro with Antonio Banderas. So, I thought, well, one day I will write about this city. And then when I started researching to write a novel placed in New Orleans, I realized that much of its flavor comes from 200 years ago when there was a slave revolt in what is now Haiti and was then the richest French colony in the world, Saint-Domingue. And the slaves were, the half a million slaves rebelled, and it is the only successful slave revolt in history. And they created the first Negro independent republic in the world, and the first independent republic in Latin America, long before Chile, Venezuela, Mexico, they were independent. And what happened with the whites when the rebellion succeeded against the troops of Napoleon, the best trained troops in Europe, the whites had to get out or they would be killed. And so in a matter of very short time, hundreds of ships left with these white families. Some went to Cuba, some went back to France, and 10,000 of them came to New Orleans. They brought with them, these white people brought their white families, but also often their domestic slaves that they trusted. And actually the domestic slaves were also often victims of the field hands that rebelled because they hated the domestics who were closer to the family and were treated better. And so they brought also their African mistresses with their children of color. And there was a golden time in New Orleans, at least 30 years of a golden time for a large number of free people of color that would send their children, their male children, to be educated in France, and the girls to the Ursuline School in New Orleans. They had wonderful music and cuisine and economic means. Some of them had plantations and some of them had slaves. So it's very interesting. In Haiti, there were 60 shades of color, and each shade had a name. And a person who had a trained eye in the colony could immediately tell in which of the 60 categories a person fit. It was very interesting, the research. So I'm going to read you. The book is written in two voices. One voice is my voice, and the other one is the voice of Sarite, the protagonist, who is I pick her up when she's 9 years old, and I follow her life until she goes to New Orleans with her master. So I will read first in the voice of Sarite when the rebellion started, which was one night. This is historical. I didn't make it up. I wish I did, but I don't have that kind of imagination. Okay. Bois-Caiman lies to the north. It is an enormous forest, a place of crossroads and sacred trees, where live the spirits of nature and of dead slaves who have not found their way to Guinea, to the island beneath the sea. That night, other spirits also came, prepared to fight because they were called. There was an army of hundreds of thousands of spirits fighting alongside the blacks, and that was finally why the whites were defeated. Everybody's in agreement about that, even the French soldiers, who felt the spirit's fury. My master, who did not believe in anything he did not understand, and as he understood very little, believed in nothing, was also convinced that the dead aided the rebels. That explained how they could defeat the best army of Europe, the army of Napoleon. The meeting of the slaves in Bois-Caiman occurred on a hot night, wet from the sweat of men and of the earth. How was the news passed? The drums carried the message. The sound of the drums traveled farther and faster than the roar of a storm, and all the people knew its language. Slaves came from the plantations in the north, and thousands of Maroons descended from the mountains. Gambo arrived with a group of Samba Bukman, a giant who inspired double respect for being a Hungan and a war chief. In the year and a half that he had been free, Gambo had grown to a man's size. He had broad shoulders and tiring legs and a machete for killing. He had won Bukman's trust. He slipped into plantations to steal food, tools, weapons, and animals. But he had never come near San Lazar to see me. During that time, my need to be with Gambo was burning me like hot coals. There is no remedy for this kind of love. I tell this with shame. Sometimes, when I lay with my master, I imagine I was with Gambo. I bit my lips to hold back his name, and in the darkness, behind my closed eyes, pretended that the white man's smell of alcohol was the green grass breath of Gambo, who had not yet rotted his teeth by eating bad fish, and that the heavy, hairy, panting man atop of me was Gambo, slim and agile, his young flesh crisscrossed with scars, his sweet lips, his curious tongue, his whispering voice. People traveled for hours and hours to reach Bois-Caiman, and they all arrived in the dark of night. The forest was filled, men and women gliding through the trees in total silence, blended with the dead and the shadows. But when they felt the vibration of the first drums on their feet, they were energized. They picked up their pace, speaking in whispers and then shouts. They greeted one another. They gave their names. A necklace of fires and torches lighted the clearing. The men had prepared the sacred potomitan, a tall, thick tree trunk, because the road for the loas, the gods, had to be wide. A long line of girls dressed in white arrived, escorting Tante Rose, also all in white, carrying their son for the ceremony. The drums in the semicircle were calling, tam, tam, tam. Bukman took the word to invoke the supreme god, Papa Bon Dieu, and to ask that he lead them to victory. Hear the voice of freedom that sings in our hearts, he shouted. And the slaves answered in a clamor that shook the island. This is how they told it. The drums began to talk an answer to set the rhythm for the ceremony. The girls danced around and they sang, calling to the loas, first Legba, as it is always done, then the rest, one by one. The drumming grew faster and the whole forest throbbed from the deepest roots to the most remote stars. Then Ogun, the spirit of war, the god of weapons, aggressive, irritable, dangerous, descended and mounted Tantros. Everyone saw the transformation. The old woman rose straight up to double her size, and with her eyes rolled back, she made an astounding leap and landed nearly 10 feet away from one of the fires. From Ogun's mouth came a bellow of thunder, and the loa danced, rising up from the ground, falling and bouncing back like a ball. Two men approached, the most courageous, to give the loa sugar to calm him. But Tantros, possessed, picked them up like rag dolls and threw them far. The loa had come to give a message of war and justice and blood. Tantros, mounted by Ogun, picked up a red hot coal, placed it in her mouth, whirled completely about sucking fire, and then spit it out without burning her lips. Then she took a large knife, went to the sacrificial black pig tied to a tree, and with her warrior's arm cut its throat with a single slash, severing the thick head from the trunk and soaking herself in its blood. By then, many followers had been mounted by the loas, and the forest was filled with loas and spirits mixed in with humans, all scrambled together, singing, dancing, leaping, and rolling to the beat of the drums, walking on burning coals, licking red-hot knife blades, and eating handfuls of hot chilies. The night air was charged, as it is during a terrible storm, but not a breeze stirred. Much later, when the huge crowd was shaking like a single person, Ogun roared to impose silence. The drums immediately stilled, and all those who were possessed, except Tantros, were again themselves as the loas retired to the tops of the trees. Ogun lifted the asson toward the sky, and the voice of the most powerful loa issued from Tantros' mouth to demand the end of slavery, to call for total rebellion, and to name the chiefs, Bougman, Jean-François, Jeannot, Boisseau, Celestin, and several others. That was the beginning of the revolution. And now I'm going to read it's my voice or hers, I don't remember. No, this is my voice, I'm sorry. I had all this marked, but I cleaned it up and now I can't read it. I made it too small also. In the summer of the following year, one night, Sarité suddenly waked with a firm hand over her mouth. She thought it was finally the attack on the plantation they had feared for so long and prayed that death would be quick, at least for the children, Maurice and Rosette, sleeping beside her. She waited without trying to defend herself to keep from waking the children and also from the remote possibility that it was all a nightmare until she could make out a figure bending over her in the light reflected from the patio torches. She did not recognize the person because the boy had changed in the year and a half they had been separated. But then he whispered her name, Sarité, and she felt a flash in her breast, not of terror, but joy. She raised her hands to pull him to her and felt the metal of the knife he held between his teeth. She took it from him and he, with a moan, dropped down upon the body that shifted to receive him. Gambo's lips sought hers with a third store up during a long absence. She opened to him, but she remembered the children she had for a moment forgotten and pushed him away. "Come with me," she whispered. They got up with care and stepped over Maurice. Gambo recovered his knife and put it in the strip of goat leather at his waist as she closed the mosquito netting to protect the children. Feeling her way, she led him to the mad woman's room on the other side of the house, empty since her death. Arms around each other, they fell upon the mattress, smelling of moisture and abandon, and made love in the darkness, in total silence, choked with unspoken words. During his absence, Gambo had found relief with other women in the camps, but he had not been able to sate his appetite for unsatisfied love. He was 17 years old and lived in flames of a persistent desire for Sarité, imagining her at every instant of repose and in every pause in battle and in every misty dawn in the millenary canyons of the Indian chiefs where he had so many times stood guard. He remembered her tall, abounding, generous, but now she was smaller than he, and her breasts, which then had seemed large, fit easily into his hands. Zarité straddled him, bending down to cover his face with kisses, lick his ears, caress him. I had to censor all the raunchy parts here, so I will skip a little bit. And they are long, let me tell you. Pages and pages of. I know you. Some of you want to hear it, but most of you don't. I have friends here who would be really embarrassed that a grandmother my age would be able to write all this. Let me tell you, it's not experience. It's imagination and research. Okay, back to the text. It's always better to leave it to people's imagination. You know, you're probably thinking of vibrators and stuff, but there was no electricity then. Or no batteries either. Okay, they calm down. This is a serious part. So we were at the part where he licks. No, she licks his ears. Who licks? No, she licks his ears and caresses him. Okay. The air in the room became saturated with the fragrance of love. Perhaps they did nothing they had not done with others, but it's very different to make love loving. Exhausted with happiness, they fell into sleep, pressed together in a knot of arms and legs, stunned by the heavy heat of that July night. Gambo waked after a few minutes, frightened for having let down his guard, but when he heard the abandoned woman purring in her sleep, he gave himself time to lightly run his hand over her, without waking her, and to take note of the changes in that body that when he left had been misshapen with child. Her breasts still held milk, but they were less firm. The nipples distended. Her waist seemed very slim, but he did not remember how it had been before her pregnancy. Her belly, her hips, her buttocks, her thighs were pure opulence and smoothness. Sarité's scent had also changed. She no longer smelled of soap, but milk, and in that moment she was imbued with their blended odors. Sarité stretched with a long, satisfied sigh. She was dreaming of Gambo, and it took her an instant to realize that they were actually together, and she did not have to imagine him. "I came to look for you, Sarité. It's time for us to go," Gambo whispered. He explained that he had not been able to come earlier because he didn't have anywhere to take her, but now he could wait no longer. He didn't know if the whites would be able to crush the rebellion, but they would have to kill the last rebel before they would proclaim victory. None of them was prepared to be a slave again. Death was on the loose and lying in wait across the island. There was no safe corner, but worse than fear and war, for them was to continue to be apart. And though she was used to the comforts of this white man's house, all he could offer was a hard life, but she would not be sorry, because once you taste freedom, you can never turn back. He felt the hot tears on Tete's face. "I can't leave the children, Gambo," she told him. "We will take my son with us," he replied. "She's a girl. Her name is Rosette, and she isn't your daughter. She's the daughter of the master." Gambo sat up, surprised. In that year and a half, thinking about his son, a black boy, the thought that the baby could be a mulatto daughter of the master had never crossed his mind. "We can't take Maurice because he's white, not Rosette because she's too small to survive hardship," Tete explained. "You have to come with me, Sarite, and it has to be tonight. Tomorrow will be too late. These are the white man's children. Forget them. Think of us and the children we will have. Think of freedom." "Why do you say that tomorrow will be too late?" she asked, wiping away tears with the back of her hand. "Because the plantation will be attacked. It is the last one left. All the rest have been destroyed." Then she understood the magnitude of what Gambo was asking. It was much more than leaving the children. It was to abandon them to a horrible fate. She turned to him with an anger as intense as the passion of minutes before. She would never leave them, not for him and not for freedom. Gambo held her tight against his chest, as if he meant to pick her up and carry her. He told her that Maurice was lost at any rate, but in the camp they would accept Rosette as long as she was not too light-skinned. "Neither of them would survive among the rebels, Gambo. The only way to sell them is for the master to take them. I'm sure he will protect Maurice with his life, but not Rosette." "There's no time for that. Your master is already a corpse, Sarite," he replied. "If he dies, the children will die too. We have to take all three away from Saint-Lazare before dawn. If you don't want to help me, I will do it alone," Tete decided, pulling on her shift in the darkness. Gambo realized he could not force her to go with him, and neither could he leave her. "Do you think the white man will agree to this?" he finally asked. "What choice does he have? If he stays, he and Maurice will be disemboweled. Not only will he accept, he will pay a good price. Wait for me here." And this is Sarite speaking. "My body was hot and moist, my face swollen with kisses and tears, and my skin scented with what I had done with Gambo, but I didn't care. In the corridor, I lighted one of the oil lamps, went to the master's room, and entered without knocking, something I had never done before. I found him limp with liquor, lying on his back, his mouth gaping open with a thread of saliva down his chin. He had a two-day beard, and his pale hair was wild. Suddenly, all the repulsion I felt for him seized me, and I thought I was going to vomit. My presence and the light took an instant to penetrate the fog of cognac in his brain. He waked with a cry and with one quick move pulled out the pistol he kept beneath his pillow. When he recognized me, he lowered the gun, but did not put it down. 'What is it, Tete?' he said with a tone of rebuke and jumped out of the bed. 'I have come to propose something to you, maître,' I told him. My voice did not tremble, nor did the lamp in my hand. He didn't ask me how it had occurred to me to wake him in the middle of the night. He sensed that it had to be something very serious. He sat on the edge of the bed with a pistol on his knees, as I explained that within hours rebels would attack Saint-Lazare. It was useless to alert the overseer. It would take an army to hold them back. Just as everywhere else, his slaves would join the attackers. There would be a slaughter and a fire, and that was why we had to flee immediately with the children, or tomorrow we would all be dead. And that would be the good fate. Worse would be to be dying slowly in horrible pain." This is how I told him. "And how did he know?" "One of our slaves who is, I told him that one of our of the slaves who had escaped more than a year ago had come back and was going to lead us because alone we would never reach Le Cap. The region was in the hands of the rebels. 'Who is he?' he asked while he hurriedly threw on some clothes. 'His name is Gambo and he is my lover.' He slapped me so hard that I was dazed. But when he started to hit me again, I grabbed his wrist with a strength I didn't know I had. Up to that very moment, I had never looked at him in the eye, and I didn't know that he had light-colored eyes like a cloudy sky. 'We are going to try to save you and Maurice, but the price will be my freedom and Rosette's,' I told him, enunciating every word very clearly so he would understand. He dug his fingers into my arms, and his face was menacingly close to mine. He ground his teeth and cursed me. His eyes were bulging with rage. A long, eternal moment passed. Again, I felt nausea, but I did not drop my eyes. At last, he sat back with his head in his hands, defeated. "You go with that bastard. You don't need me to free you." "And Maurice? You can't protect him. I don't want to live always running away. I want to be free," I replied. "Very well, you will have what you ask for. Come, hurry, get dressed, and get the children ready. Where is that slave?" he asked. "He isn't a slave any longer. I will call him. But first, you write me the paper that will free Rosette and me." Without another word, he sat down at his desk, took a piece of paper, and hurriedly wrote, dried the ink with talc, blew on it, then imprinted his ring on sealing wax, as I had always seen him do with important documents. He read it to me aloud, since I couldn't read. My throat clutched and my heart began to pound in my chest. That sheet of paper had the power to change my daughter's life and mine. I folded it four times and put it in the little pouch I always wore around my neck beneath my blouse. Thank you very much. Well, thank you, Gioconda, for doing this.
What a joy to be with Isabel Allende, who has brought Latin America to so many people in the world.
Thank you.
All the magic, the sounds, the smells, the beauty of our lands.
Well, so have you, by the way.
Thank you very much. I want to start with two comments. One is the wide sweep of this novel about Haiti that is so encompassing. It goes to so many places that is quite a feat for a writer. And also the other thing that moved me very much was the perfection of the translation. It is such an amazing translation done by Margaret Sayers-Piren, who's been Isabel's translator, and that is so important, you know.
Well, actually, she improves my books. She does. She really does. When I send her the manuscript, she's the first person to read my books. Before, it was my mom, but now my mother is 90, and she says I just don't have the patience to read your stuff. So I send it to Pech, and Pech sends me every 20 or 30 pages, and I get a chance to correct my Spanish when I read the translation, because I see it with the filter of another language.
Yeah, it's an amazing experience.
She's wonderful. Huh? She's 83 years old, lives in Missouri, and she's fantastic.
So I wanted to ask Isabel, because the timing of this publication that was so close to the Haitian earthquake, it brings about this question of whether the writer is a seer or a prophet.
I hope not. God, I hope not.
No, but the novel, in my opinion, seems to be born of a wish of yours to tell people something about the history of Haiti. Because through all these characters and through their development and what they do, really what you get to do is to live that part of the history of Haiti. So it was like a will to be helpful to the Haitian people.
Gioconda,
no, I know
not
you
at all.
Weren't, but I...
Not at all. I'm no seer, and the truth is that I don't want to deliver a message. I don't want to tell anybody, I don't want to teach anything or to bring forward a mission or nothing. I just love storytelling, like you do. And I just want to tell a story. And if in the story, between the lines, the reader sees or finds information, historical events, or even my own values, well, so be it. But it's not my intention at all.
But don't you think that there is a reason why one attracts stories or subjects whose purpose is revealed to you afterwards? I wanted to ask you, how do you think about time, for example? Because there is that for me brings about the notion of time as a fluid thing. You know, we don't know if we live, maybe we are capable of seeing through time, and there is a capacity of the writer that is given by the fact that you are so open to your environment.
Well, I think that
earthquakes. I feel earthquakes coming.
Well, I come from a land of earthquakes. I think that artists in general, writers also, are attuned to something that is in the air, that is like the collective dream, the collective fear, the collective history,
yes,
consciousness. And if we are lucky and we can tap into that, we will draw something that is in the air. There was a moment, for example, in Latin America, where four novels about dictators were written by great Latin American writers and published the same year. And of course, they didn't know that the other one was writing about the same thing. And the novels were quite different, but dictatorship was in the air. I mean, we had been living it for a decade when the novels appeared. So it was there, like vibrating. And some people, many people picked it up. And I don't think I was in any way channeling the earthquake. I hope not. I hope I'm not responsible for the earthquake. But it is an eerie coincidence that it would happen now that the book is published, the earthquake and the spill in New Orleans.
So tell me what.
I hope I'm not responsible for that either.
We hope not.
Yeah.
So what brought you to Haiti, to write about Haiti?
I wasn't planning to write about Haiti. I was planning to write about New Orleans.
Oh.
And I started, the idea started there, and then it sort of drifted toward Haiti, and the novel is really divided in two parts. The first part is in this plantation in Haiti, then the middle is all the revolution. And the second part is in New Orleans, where life for the slaves was much better. And the reason was economics. In the United States, at that time, the trade, the slave trade, had been outlawed. So slaves were very expensive and difficult to get. While in the colonies, in the Caribbean, they were almost disposable.
Mm-hmm.
In this French colony in Saint-Domingue, there were 500,000 slaves, and the ones that worked in the fields would live 4 to 6 years. Every year, they would import between 20 and 30,000 slaves to replace the ones that died, just to keep the numbers, because nobody expected them to live much longer. And they were so cheap that it didn't matter. It was better to bring young people than to try to give them, the other ones, a humane treatment. And you know, this is interesting because when I finished the book, or when I was going to finish the book, I got in touch with abolitionist movements in the United States and in the world today. Today there are more slaves in the world than ever before in history. There are 27 million slaves counted, and probably just as many that have not been counted. And they are not, as one would think, just the little girls in the brothels in Cambodia of the sex slave trade, but whole villages. For example, 1 million people living in Pakistan just in agriculture in what is called debt bondage. That is slavery. So someone gets in a debt, and then his family and his descendants will be enslaved until the debt is paid, and it's never paid because the interest keep adding. There are slaves in the fishing industry, lumber industry, in the diamonds, sweatshops, everywhere, in every country. And because no country admits that they have slaves, they're invisible. They have no voice. They are disposable. You can buy a girl for $10. And in Haiti, today, this country that fought so hard for its liberation, to be emancipated, to abolish slavery, today there are 300,000 children enslaved, and they are between ages 5 to whatever, teenagers, enslaved as domestic servants because their families cannot support them. So they give them away or they sell them for 12 bucks.
Yeah, I read that the modern slave trade is 80% are women.
Women and children.
Yeah, and it's incredible, terrible.
Google free the slaves and you'll get all the information. And maybe you can get involved in helping.
So about the erotic part.
That's the part that my mother doesn't want to read. I'm waiting until she dies to write a really erotic novel.
So your mother, you're afraid of your mother.
I'm terrified.
At this point.
She's a Catholic, and she's an old lady, and she gets horrified. She says, when she reads that, she says, oh, my God, people will think that you've done it. I wish.
The power of the imagination, all by itself.
Well, I live in my imagination.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
No, I wanted to ask you, is there between Gambo and Zarité, is a statutory rape?
No.
Because when we meet him, he's 14 years old. How old is she?
But she's very young too. They're both teenagers.
I couldn't get that.
Yeah, she's older than him, but not that much older. And they are really in love. They fall in love, and they have a beautiful relationship that lasts very briefly because he's planning to run away, and she can't run away with him because she's pregnant. And she doesn't know if the baby she's expecting is from Gambo or the master. Mm-hmm. So then there's another point in the novel. Oh, no, but I'm not going to tell you that because then I will ruin the book for you.
I wanted to ask you about, as a novelist, you have often revisited the past in your fiction. In The House of the Spirits, of Love and Shadows, in Retrato en Sepia, in Es of My Soul. What is there to be found in the past that you want to bring back to us, to illuminate for us? Have you ever considered writing about the future?
No, I've never considered writing about the future, although I love science fiction, but I don't think I would be capable of doing that. But I have written about modern times, I have written memoirs. Right now I'm writing a novel that is about young people last year here, so it's very contemporary. Mm-hmm. But I love historical novels because once I do the research of a time and a place, half the novel is done. I have a theater where I can move my characters, and the research gives me a lot that it would be impossible for me to imagine. When I was doing the research for this book, I couldn't possibly imagine the cruelty, the brutality that the enslaved people suffered in those plantations in Saint-Domingue. And then I said, what made me sick, physically sick, was realizing that every time we human beings have power and impunity, we commit atrocious acts against other people. And I have to examine my own soul, Gioconda, and say, what would I do? If I would have been born 200 years ago and I was the wife of a planter in Haiti, how would I behave? Would I handle that with the ideas that I have today? No, probably not. And I would probably be just as brutal. So I'm very happy that my circumstances have been such that I have never had to commit an act like that, because I don't want to test my humanity. Really.
Now, Toulouse was you chose as your character a person who was kind of illuminated for his time, and that tried to have a plantation that was more humane. No, I don't know. Obviously, he didn't succeed completely, but he had ideas that led him to have a plantation that was less brutal. But at the same time, his relationship to Sarité is very interesting because, for me, she's such a contradictory character in a good way. I mean, in an interesting way. Because on one hand, this is a woman that wants to run away. This is a woman who has, when the sound of drums gets to her, she becomes almost possessed by this music and this desire for freedom. But at the same time, and at every moment in her development as a character, in every crisis, she somehow chooses loyalty. No, loyalty over freedom, loyalty to this master who has been abusing her for such
a long
time.
Well, actually, she chooses the children. She chooses always the children first, and I think that most mothers would. So he has her, he controls her because he has many ways of controlling her, but the love of the children is what really holds her back. Mm-hmm. What was your question? I got
no,
lost.
That's what I wanted to, the contradictory nature of her character. I mean, that she has on one hand all this incredible rebelliousness, and on the other hand, she is like mellow, very mellow. I know that the children pull her back, but at the same time, there is also another layer. I interpret it like the layer of slavery, how much, talking about humanity, how much living in that condition kills, you know, your capacity to a certain extent.
Well, obviously, there were families. It's very interesting to research about what happened, for example, with these families in New Orleans, or also in Haiti. The white man had absolute control and power over these women, the African women. But often they got attached. They would fall in love. There would be children. There would be a sense of family and loyalty. There's a point when Toulouse Valmorin, the master, has to emancipate her because she has saved his life and the life of his child. And he doesn't. And he cheats and doesn't.
Yeah.
Because he's attached to her. He doesn't want to lose her. And he can't understand why she wants to be free if he is protecting her and giving her what he thinks is a good life. And she says, it doesn't matter, I don't want a good life, I just want to be free. He doesn't understand it. And I think that in many ways that happens with women, because we could also translate this today and say, how many women live enslaved in many places in the world, depending completely on a man that abuses them, and the man would never understand why she wants to leave him. Because she's protected, she has food on the table, she has children. What does she want? And all that is very, very complex and very interesting. The other thing that was very interesting was that in New Orleans, when there was an institution called Plassage.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this also explains the complexity of relationships in times of slavery. In New Orleans, there was a large number of free people of color, and the women were very powerful, the educated, powerful. They had economic resources. They were usually much more powerful than the men, and they had daughters and sons. And the sons would be sent to France, often have a profession, come back with a profession. What do they do with the girls? According to the law, there was no rape, for example, if the woman was not white. There was no crime if a white man mm-hmm. raped a woman of color. So how would this mother protect her daughter against the lust or the abuse of the white population? Could it be a woman or a man? She couldn't. She could not protect her daughter even if the daughter was married to a black man. She could not. The black husband could not protect her. So often these mothers would choose to find a white protector for their daughters, and that was called placage. And to be placed was like being married, but you were married to a white man in this sort of tacit agreement. Nothing was written, but it was an honorable agreement. And it was not prostitution at all. And there was a ball, the Cordon Bleu ball in New Orleans, where the mothers would introduce their daughters, 14, 15 years old, trained, educated in the Ursulines, trained for beauty and to keep a house. And they were much better educated than the white girls and much better looking too. And they had a sense of their beauty and their power. So they would introduce them to whom? The fathers of boys that were around 18, would not want their boys, their sons, to go to prostitutes because syphilis was rampant. And so they would prefer the boys to have a steady mistress. So they would go to these balls, and the father would bring his boy, and if the son danced three times with the same girl, the father was obliged to go to the chaperone or the mother of the girl and establish a negotiation, initiate a negotiation in which there was an agreement. And the agreement always included a house in a rampant street. And it was all the houses were more or less similar, a pension, and the obligation also to educate the children. And these relationships would last usually until it was time for the boy to marry at around 28, let's say a decade. So he would marry with a person of his class, a white woman, and it was an arranged marriage, a contract of some kind. Often they kept the family of color, or the woman was then free, the woman of color was free to marry, and they would usually marry a black man. Mm-hmm. But she already had the house, educated children, and a pension. And it was an honorable agreement. It was not at all a dishonor. It was all just as being married. Of course, the white women pretended that that was not happening because the competition was ferocious. And the white women were so jealous that they did not, there were laws that the women of color, these beautiful mulatto women, could not wear hats, and they could not wear jewelry in public. They could not wear silk or velvet. All that was privilege of the whites. But indoors, these women had all the jewelry and all, and they were splendid. Splendid. Much more attractive than the white ladies, who were also, you know, these Protestant people. Sometimes, no, in that case, they were Catholics. Can you imagine? Catholic and illiterate.
And that was...
and virgins. Give me a break.
Terrible.
Terrible, I mean. I remember when I was that.
So
when
do I.
A Catholic virgin? Give me a break. It was awful. I still remember, you know, it was like a century ago, but I do remember. The first time that someone held my hand in the movies, I thought I was pregnant. And I married the guy because I really married him because he had, you know, we had had intercourse.
I forget what I was going to ask you.
Well, you have it written.
You distracted me. I wanted to ask you about your choices in the novel to not use the historical characters, but as background. I mean, most of your characters, I think, are fictional. For example, why didn't you have Toussaint de Louverture have a role in the novel?
Because these people, my characters, moved in a context, a historical context. There were things happening politically and socially that I could not ignore. How could I ignore Toussaint Louverture in a novel about the revolt of the slaves in Haiti? It's impossible. I couldn't ignore Napoleon because what was happening, or the French Revolution, because what was happening in France impacted the colonies. I couldn't, the Louisiana Purchase, for example, it made New Orleans an American city. And it's very funny because the...
That is a fascinating, I love that about your book, because I had never thought about what it was for people during the Louisiana Purchase. I mean, to be all of a sudden...
Taken over by another country that they feared. They thought that all Americans were dressed in buffalo
hides,
and that they would eat with their boots on the table, which was partly true actually. And it was just, and they thought that they spoke this language, English, and they think that we are going to speak English. They must be out of their minds. They will have to learn French.
And they were so sophisticated in comparison to the Americans. And that was a fantastic...
Actually, in the city, when the Americans took over, there was a street that divided the part that was Catholic, French, where all the music was and the good cuisine and the beautiful courtesan, and the Protestant part of the Americans on the other side, where everybody was bored.
But they were working very hard.
Oh, they were working. They were working so hard that the French had to leave.
So, did any of the characters in the novel are inspired in any specific historical character or not?
Some of the characters that seem fictional are real people. For example, Père Antoine, the priest in New Orleans, really existed, and the story that I tell is true. He was sent by the Inquisition, and he didn't have the raw material to be an inquisitor, and he hated the job. And the people in New Orleans wouldn't stand an inquisitor either, so they sent him in shackles back to Spain, where he went from being a Dominican to being a Franciscan, and returned 5 years later as a Franciscan and became this saint that to this day people think that the ghost of Père Antoine walks in the streets of New Orleans at night.
And what about Island Beneath the Sea?
The title?
I couldn't say it right. Beneath the Sea.
Yeah.
The
La
title,
Isla Bajo
yes.
el Mar.
Sí, La Isla Bajo el Mar. Is it a... Because you mentioned it like the heaven, you know?
Yeah.
Like Sarité thinks it's the heaven, and I think Tante Rose mentions it too. Is there such a place in the mythology of Guinea?
Yes. The slaves... believed that when they died, their souls would go back to the paradise lost, and they would go to the island beneath the sea, Guinea. Why the island beneath the sea? Because they had come by sea. They had been brought by sea in the bottom of the ships, and many of them had never seen the ocean before. So can you imagine how traumatizing that trip was? If half the cargo would reach the destination alive, it was a good trip. Half would die. And so they would go to the island beneath the sea in order to go to paradise. And that's where the title of the book comes from.
What about all
My God, it's so cold in here. Aren't you cold? Yes, it's freezing. Can we just turn the air conditioning down?
It's a contrast to Haiti.
Huh?
It's for a contrast to Haiti.
My God, I'm shaking.
You made me lose my track again. I was fascinated by all the beliefs and the laws and all those things that you mentioned. Those are all from Guinea? I mean, where did you take all that from, the mythology?
From voodoo. You know, we have this idea of voodoo that Hollywood has given us, these zombie movies. And it's a religion. just as respectable as any other religion. And it has one God only.
Excuse me, somebody's giving you his jacket.
What's happening? Oh, that's so nice. Thank you. Yeah, actually, it doesn't fit my outfit, but it doesn't matter. Thank you. Thank you so much. You know, this is fine. No, I'm fine. Thank you. That's enough. Thanks.
She cannot say no to the gentleman.
Do you have a hot bottle of water? We were talking about voodoo. And actually, it's a very respectable religion. And what was very interesting in the research is that in the calendars, the ceremonies, the loas would descend with the drumming and the drumming and the dancing. People would fall in a trance. Mm-hmm. And the loas would mount the practitioner. And this experience of the divinity inside is very empowering. We very seldom do that. I have felt that only once on drugs. but really, it's an extraordinary thing to be empowered by God. Can you imagine? And so they would face the cannons of Napoleon with a machete, naked, convinced that they were invincible, that they the bullets wouldn't hurt them. It was wonderful in that sense.
And didn't they do, no, that was a different story.
Yes, it's another author and another book. Our age is showing, Gioconda.
That's good. It would be bad if they didn't show. You
no,
know?
I don't want it to show. I'm spending a fortune to try to keep it at bay. I hate old age. And I hate children, too. I wish I could remain like in my 40s, you know. 40s is a good age.
Yeah, it's true. 40s are great. I love the
place. Right before menopause. It's perfect.
Okay, let's get serious now.
Yeah.
The last time I interviewed you, you said that your principal interest was just telling stories that captivate you. But I felt in this novel in particular an intent to making your writing fulfill a social function. Has your thinking changed to that purpose?
No, it has not. I have a foundation, and I do the social work through the foundation. But writing is not, it doesn't have a purpose, a mission, except the love of stories and the love of our crazy humanity. People are so weird. We do such strange things. We are so contradictory, so stupid sometimes, that it is fascinating to write about us, you know?
So you see yourself as a witness to the real world, let's say. That's
but a witness, and I also participate in the real world in the sense that I'm as crazy as everybody else. And it was very interesting because one thing that I have been fearing in this book tour is the fact that I'm writing about slavery and I am a Latino woman. I was thinking the reviewers or the interviewers, the press, will say, well, why you? About this subject that has nothing to do with you culturally. Actually, in Chile, we did not have plantations, and we never had African slaves. We, of course, enslaved the Indians, but we didn't bring African slaves.
And finish them off, like in many other places.
Well, almost finish them off. And then I only had one question in Barnes & Noble in New York, an African-American man who asked the question that I was expecting all the time. And he said, what gives you the right to write about this that is not in your culture? Who do you know? How can you know about this? And I said, why wouldn't I? What makes me different from you?
Yeah.
I mean, we are all human, aren't we? Why can't you feel what I cannot feel? We feel the same way. Hatred, love, fear, greed. The same way. The only difference is the color of the skin. but he's not different from me, so I can write about whatever I want. I have written about prostitutes, about bandits, torturers. That doesn't mean that I need to torture someone in order to imagine how it is. That's what makes me a writer.
That happened. That happened to me when I wrote my novel about Juana of Spain. When I was in Spain, somebody said, how come you, a Nicaraguan woman, is writing about the Queen of Spain? It's a ridiculous question.
Completely ridiculous.
Now, I want to ask you, in the New York Times book review, you got reviewed. I didn't like the review at all. I imagine
I
you
never
didn't
liked the
either.
New York Times book review. It's always bad for me.
And it's very petty, but there was one thing that was interesting, that they criticized you very much, like you had betrayed magical realism.
Yeah, well, but in the previous novel, they said that I had too much magic realism. Go figure.
See, the framing of, what do you think of that tendency to frame writers within a style? Do you feel that you have been framed within a certain style?
But I think that most Latin American writers, or at least of my generation, and the older ones, all the writers of the boom are older than me, let me tell you. And I look much better than most of them. But we have all been labeled with magic realism, and they expect us to write like Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And if you don't, then you are sort of betraying a style. That's ridiculous. I have written 20 books, and in some of them there is elements of magic realism, and in others, no. It depends on the story. I wrote a trilogy for young adults, and before writing that trilogy, I researched what kids like, because as I told you before, I don't like kids. So I had to find out who my audience would be, my readers, no? So I conducted a few, facilitated a few book clubs for kids of different ages and discovered that all kids like fantasy until puberty. And then in puberty, the girls like more realistic stories in which they can identify with the problems of the, mm-hmm. of the protagonists. While the boys keep on reading fantasy until... until they start reading science fiction, and from there they move to the stock market. They never land. So I said, okay, everybody likes fantasy. My readers will like fantasy, so let's see how we do this. And I can't write fantasy because I don't believe in that shit. Let me explain. Fantasy... I have to write about something that I believe. That's why I can't write romance novels, because I don't believe in the Polynesian island where there is this beautiful virgin with big breasts and green eyes, and then the CEO that comes in a yacht gets stranded in the island. I don't believe in that thing. It has never happened to anybody I know. So what is the difference between fantasy and magic realism? Magic realism can happen. Fantasy, I have never seen it. For example, the invisibility cloak in Harry Potter, it makes Harry Potter disappear. I can't write about that because I don't think that that's possible. But invisible Indians in the Amazon is possible because they paint their bodies in the colors of nature and they walk so swiftly between the trees that they can be 3 yards away and you don't see them. So that would be magic realism. It has an explanation. And I can write about that because I've seen it. I have experienced it. How many times we experience things that we can't explain, that we don't control at all, like dreams, coincidences, prophetic dreams, or things that happen all the time. This idea, this sense that we've been here before, we've done this before, we can guess things, or the crazy stuff that happens because of an emotion. We go to war because someone has an emotion. So, and that is uncontrollable and unexplainable. So that would be magic realism. And I think it's present in literature everywhere. Read Toni Morrison. It's not Latin American.
No, it's, and the, but fantasy, you think about Jules Verne, for example.
Yeah.
He was very fantastic in his time.
But yes,
he thought about going to the moon. He thought about a submarine.
But all that is possible.
Well, it wasn't possible at the time.
But he could imagine that that would be science fiction. He could imagine that that was possible and that wouldn't be fantasy.
But don't you think that when you fantasize things, sometimes you fantasize because those things can happen, be possible?
No, I have erotic fantasies that will never happen. Never.
Because you haven't believed in it.
Huh?
You haven't believed in them.
I do believe in them, but I write them, but I know it's never going
to happen. For
example,
we could have a discussion about the invisibility cloak, because I think there will be an invisibility cloak.
I wish there would be an invisibility cloak for the cellulite.
Because, you know, we are going...
That'd be great. That'd be wonderful. Invisibility pants for cellulite.
We are going to travel.
That's what we all
want.
That
would be fantastic. I agree with you. Okay. There is a paradox of being a successful writer. The very thing that you did that brought you success are undermined by the things that success brings to you. One cannot write during a grueling 13-19 city book tour, signing tour. And Cyril Connolly said, of all the enemies of literature, success is the most insidious. And Trollope said, success is a poison that should only be taken late in life and then only in small doses. What do you think of this?
Well, I believe that you have to be stupid to believe in your own success, because my life has been a roller coaster. I have been up and down so many times. And sometimes when I have thought that everything is perfect, that my life is perfect, that I'm great, and then I fall flat on my face. And it goes like this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I know that when I'm up and happy and everything is fine, something will happen. And I'm prepared. I'm prepared for success and for failure. And I don't believe either. I think that both are temporary. It will pass. And it doesn't define me as a human being. I'm defined by other things, not by what I do, performance, or the approval of other people. It has to be something in your soul, inside.
But it doesn't affect your writing, don't you feel like?
No, it doesn't at all.
You don't feel like you have to deliver that people expect
something from you? No, because every book is different, and every book is a new challenge. And I'm just as scared when on January 8th I sit down to write today as I did 25 years ago.
And you keep doing it on January 8th.
Yeah, and I have the same discipline and the same humble attitude, because I know that it's something that may happen or may not. That it's often a gift from heaven. Who knows if it's going to happen?
So
who knows why a story is going to... How could I possibly know that my books would be accepted by people or liked by people? You can't guess that. Nobody can.
So what is the book that you love the most of all that you have written?
Paula.
Paula.
Yeah, because Paula, in a way, sort of saved my life.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, I get a lot of mail. Now that email is available, I get hundreds of emails. And always, every day, there is someone somewhere in the world that is reading Paula and sends me a message. People won't write to you because they like a novel.
Yeah.
The world is full of novels. People will write if they feel a connection to something that happened in the book. And everybody has had losses in their lives. So people write because they have had a loss, or they feel connected, or they feel close. That book has brought me close to people in ways that are really extraordinary.
Now I have this question that is very, I love this about, this is from Margaret Atwood, that I love. She says, the devil comes to a writer and says, I will make you the best, most famous writer of your time. You will be influential and your fame and glory will last for a long time, for all time. All you have to do is sell me your grandmother, your mother, your wife, your kids, your husband in this case, your dog, and your soul. The writer quickly reaches for the pen, begins to sign the contract, and suddenly he pauses and looks up and asks, wait a minute, what's the catch? Yes. Well, all of you get it. He said, to work as a writer, one usually has already given up one's own family, one's dog, one's soul, basically all the things that the devil was asking to sell. How do you juggle all the challenge of not losing your husband, your children, everything in the process?
I put them in the books.
No, but in your everyday life, I mean, because I feel, for example, sometimes I don't want anybody to talk to me. I would like to disappear. I hate them all. You know, I want to kill the dog. I want to kill my husband.
You want to give away your dog?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, that's terrible. That is terrible.
Oh. Yeah. And my cat, too.
Well, the cat doesn't matter, but the dog.
And the birds. Yeah.
You know, I'm lucky. Nobody wants to be with me. So when I'm writing, everybody's really happy. And they sort of, we have a very close-knit family that is sort of supporting me so that I will keep on writing. And every time I announce that I may retire, everybody panics. So they want me in the pool house, in the back of the house, writing. That's what they want. So it doesn't affect my family at all.
You're very lucky.
It really doesn't. They're very happy.
So I was going to ask you a serious question, but I think I will pass. Do you believe that in the future there will be, believe, I ask you to believe, that in the future there is a time machine? Which period of history would you like to go back to?
None. I want to believe in the future. I think the world is getting better, not worse.
So you want to go forward?
Of course. I don't want to live in times of slavery or Inquisition or
how far
times when there was no Viagra and no antibiotics. Why would I want to live there? Are you kidding?
How far forward would you like to go?
Who's laughing? Someone who's taking Viagra is laughing over there.
Okay. This has been a lot of fun. Which woman of the past would you like to meet?
None. There was no plastic surgery
really?
In the past.
But would you like to meet, for example, Virginia Woolf or somebody like that?
Look, those women committed suicide.
But she was
there was
great.
A reason why she committed suicide. Huh? She was depressed.
No, before.
Why would I want to have dinner with a depressed person? I'd rather read her books.
No, but she wasn't a depressed person. I disagree with you because during the time of the Bloomsbury group, she was a super funny person.
But she ended up committing suicide.
Because she didn't have Prozac.
She didn't have what?
Yeah, she would never have committed suicide today. You are right in that we are very advanced.
Yeah, what? Yeah, of course.
You know, with
you
Prozac,
know, people,
with
people
Paxil.
Say, would you like to have dinner with the Dalai Lama? And I love the Dalai Lama, but he's vegetarian. Why would I want to have dinner with a vegetarian? No way.
My favorite, okay, we are going to finish now. My favorite quote of this woman was an Aphrodite. When you wrote that you wanted to make a taco, With Antonio Banderas. I
no,
like
I
that
didn't.
Very much.
I didn't want. I had a dream. I had a dream that I placed a naked Antonio Banderas on a Mexican tortilla. I slathered him with guacamole and salsa. Yeah. And then I rolled him up and I ate him. And then, but you know, I had another dream that there was a swimming pool full of arroz con leche. And Antonio Banderas was swimming naked in the arroz con leche. So I was obsessed with Antonio Banderas. I'm so glad that he's getting older now and fatter. I'm very, very happy that that's happening.
So
you are so kind to lend me your jacket. I survived this event thanks to your jacket. Thank you.
Well, on that happy note, thank you very much. Thank you to the Aloud program, to Luis Steinemann, to Isabel.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.